Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by GhostBed.com. Welcome to Drinking Bros, kids. This is a special day for us here. Childhood hero is on the show today. The legendary quarterback of the 85 Bears, Mr. Jim McMahon, is on the show today. Jim, thanks for being with us. This is a huge honor.
Hey, my pleasure, guys. Good to be with you.
Yeah, I'm almost nervous a little bit because, look, you were the first football team that I saw as a child, and it just happened to be the most dominant team of all time. And now, you know, nobody's ever topped that team going forward. So I feel like I peaked as a child, and we just haven't gotten any better since.
Well, I feel the same way. We didn't do it much after that. I mean, we did go to the playoffs the next 4 years, but didn't do too well at home in the playoffs, but we had a pretty good football team for that 5 year stretch.
Yeah. But it's got to be strange though, being on the grid. Cause in my opinion, this is the greatest team of all time. I know everybody talks about the undefeated Dolphins team from the '70s, but in my opinion, this is the very best team of all time. But then after that, it's like, where do you go? And how do you get up for that the following years?
Well, the next year, you know, after going 15-1, we ended up 14-2. We weren't that bad.
Yeah.
Had best record, but like I said, we kept screwing up in the playoffs at home. And it's unfortunate. You know, like you said, we had a hell of a football team. We were the youngest team in the league in 85, so we should have, you know, won a couple more. But, you know, losing at home in the playoffs is never a good thing.
No, I can't imagine. I mean, you want to win your last game of the season, regardless of where it is. But, man, 14-1. Or I'm sorry, 14.
You build advantage, and then you don't take advantage of it. That was our biggest flaw.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, Dan and I talk about it all the time with the Golden State Warriors. When you're that great, and then it's just you're expected to win every single year. Like you were talking about, like you go 14-2 the next year, and you're expected to win, and you don't win. It's got to be crippling inside where you're just like, man, we could have had three or four more titles.
Well, everybody on that team realizes that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get a lot of blame for it. But, you know, I was hurt a lot, which, you know, that was most of my career. You know, I only played 7 seasons in Chicago. I played 8 more years and I was still getting hurt. But, you know, that's just part of the game. And we had capable guys behind me, and unfortunately, we just didn't get it done.
Yeah, and you know, speaking of part of the game, I felt that team has changed a part of today's game in the fact that you guys were the first team that was like really branding yourselves, making a brand out of who the Bears were, mm-hmm. who you were as a person. And I felt that not only media and sports media changed after that, but so did advertising, where it was front and center, and you guys were everywhere. Like, you were the guy. Were you aware of that at the time, and was that intentional?
Well, you know, being paid what the Bears were paying me, I needed some outside income. So.
No kidding. You know, it's
I had very fortunate because I did get to do a lot of advertisements and was able to make a good chunk of change off the field, and
right.
Had 4 little kids at the time, so it was well needed.
Yeah, because the NFL salaries weren't what they are now, you know. And when you look at guys like Dak Prescott turning down $35 million a year, do you ever look back and be like, man, I would have taken that in 2 seconds?
Well, I played 15 years in the NFL. I made $1 million one of those years. So, and that was year 12, I think, in Minnesota. But other than that, it was well below $1 million. And these guys, I went through 2 strikes, so these guys can make what they're making now.
Right.
And I would just hope that you would hope that the league would take care of the older guys by, you know, keeping them on the insurance plan and this and that. But, you know, pretty much once you're out of the league, you're on your own. So. And then the guys are, you know, they develop all these problems, you know, in their 40s and 50s. And, you know, I'm in my 60s now. So I'm still struggling. But, you know, I'm doing okay financially because what I did off the field.
Yeah, and you've been one of those guys who have been very, very vocal about the NFL taking care of its players after the game. Obviously, it's been well documented that you were diagnosed with, you know, early onset dementia, and then you struggle with memory loss and severe headaches and depression and things like that.
Yeah, we just had Cyril Wecht on the show the other day. He was the Allegheny County coroner for a long time. And one of his employees or one of his colleagues at the time was Bennett Amalo, the guy that, you know, started discovering all the concussion stuff. So we've been talking about this a lot lately. And, you know, it's a big thing for the veteran folks as well, because we get quite a few concussions, even like rapid succession, mild grade concussions, particularly from explosions and things like that that happen both in training and overseas. And it's not good.
No, I mean, it's a huge problem. And the guy that's helping me, Dr. Scott Rosa, he's out of New York, but he's also involved in some military studies now, and hopefully get you guys taken care of as well.
How bad is it on a day-to-day basis for you? Describe what you go through throughout the day. Because I feel, me personally, and obviously Dan as well, that the more and more we're able to get these stories out and share them to the world, I mean, we've got 10.3 million listeners on this show, the more that people can become aware of what happens when you get brain injuries and the help you need afterwards. Because a lot of the time, you know, when you get a concussion or things like that, if your leg is not broken in half like Joe Theismann on the field, people kind of forget about it. They're like, all right, sweet. It's a concussion. How big a deal is it? Describe what you've been going through, you know, since leaving the league.
Well, obviously at the time we didn't know, you know, we knew we were going to be beat up physically, you know, shoulders, knees, stuff like that, but nobody ever mentioned the brain. And, you know, they've known for a long time what was going to be happening. And it's unfortunate. You know, a lot of guys, I was in the same position a lot of these guys who've taken their life are. There was times that I'd have to be in a dark room for weeks at a time. I couldn't sit up or stand up because the pounding in my head was so bad. And so at first I couldn't believe that these guys would actually take their own life, but I had the same thoughts myself. Because the pain got so bad, and then, the forgetfulness, you know, you walk into a room and then you stand there for 30 minutes trying to figure out what the hell you're in there for. It got unbearable. And thank God that these guys, these doctors in New York contacted me. I did a Sports Illustrated cover, I think in 2012 or something like 11, something like that. And they read the story and they contacted me and said, hey, come to New York. We think we can help you. And, they said, you're gonna have to be there a week. So I flew there, stayed a week. They sat me down. They said, well, this is what we think is going on, that you have a blockage somewhere in your head or your neck that is causing your spinal fluid to back up into your brain. And they put me into the CAT scan, and that's exactly what they found. I had three different blockages at C1 and 2, C6 and 7. What the hell was the other one? Yeah, I can't even remember that. But. You know, your atlas bone is supposed to be perpendicular to your spine. Mine was almost straight up and down.
Wow.
I just went a month ago, and it'd been about 9 months. I usually go every 3 months because of COVID and everything about flying. Mm-hmm. It took me 9 months to get back to see him, and he put me back in the CAT scan. And he said he was glad he did, because the atlas bone, again, was about 30-something degrees off where it should have been. So he said, you're starting to have headaches. I said, well, I've been having headaches for a while, but couldn't get on a plane. So, it's very frustrating. I know these guys are proud and tough and everything, and they don't want to ask for help. But, you got to, because when your head starts messing with it, you don't know what to do.
Yeah, that's a problem for a lot of whatever you want to call it, alpha type people, athletes, first responders, military folk. You don't really know how to ask for help or when it's appropriate to, but you do think about the consequences of asking for help. Like if you're particularly if you're in the NFL now, everybody knows about the concussion issue. If you start complaining about headaches, they're going to pull you, right?
Yeah. I was watching the game last night, and one guy's been sitting out for 3 games because of a concussion.
Yeah.
He said he feels fine and wants to play, obviously, but the doctors have said otherwise. It's one of those issues where you don't want to say that you have it, because you'll be out. Somebody else could take your job. Like, the NFL is a ruthless business.
Yeah.
And, you know, once you're out, you might not get that job back again.
Right.
Yeah. Out of sight, out of mind, very easily, boys. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a wild.
I don't even know why they called the concussion lawsuit. It really didn't have anything about to do with concussions, because unless you have ALS, dementia, Parkinson's, what else? There was a couple other brain diseases that you have to have in order to get paid. And, you know, I was one of the named plaintiffs in that lawsuit. I was flat out denied. I was told I was not impaired enough. And, you know, I'm not done with them yet, but, you know, I don't want to wait till I actually develop, you know, one of these things. You know, I've already got some issues, and they tell me I'm not damaged enough. When am I going to be damaged enough? You know, so.
Yeah,
it's crazy. Hopefully they'll this will get taken care of, because I'm sure I'm going to get one of these diseases, but I'd like to enjoy a little something before then.
Yeah. In your opinion, do you think that the $3 billion settlement from the NFL was enough? Because clearly, if you were one of the main plaintiffs and it didn't help you, it isn't enough. And what more do players have to go through legally? Because look, a legal process against the NFL is fucking brutal. It's time consuming. And I can't even imagine how much you've spent financially.
Well, that's why they would rather go to litigation, because they know they can outlast us. You know, we can't keep paying to, you know, do appeals and this and that.
Yeah.
And they can, you know, you know, that's the league. That's what they do.
It is, yeah. And they just keep chucking people back in, and whatever happens, happens. One of the interesting facts that Dan brought up to me right before we came on the show is I did not know you were the backup quarterback on that Green Bay team that also won a Super Bowl.
Yeah, what was it, 95? 96. 96, yeah.
Yeah.
96, yeah.
And that was Brett Favre's year, obviously. What was that like, mentoring at that point, a younger-ish Favre? And did you guys get along during that?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I mean, he's a heck of a guy, a great athlete, just a tough kid. He just loved to play the game, loved to have fun in the locker room and meetings and so forth. But, you know, I didn't have to do a hell of a lot. I don't think I sweated the year and a half I was there. Coach Holmgren just kind of, he said, "You want to take any reps?" And I said, "Well, am I going to get any in the game?" He goes, "Probably not." And I said, "Well, I'm not going to take any today then." we got on great. And yeah, it was nice to be able to go out my final year and get a Super Bowl, another Super Bowl ring. So I got ranked from the two oldest franchises in the league. So that was pretty cool to end my career that way.
Yeah, they won the first three, right? Green Bay and Chicago won the first three Super Bowls, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, that's pretty. No,
Chicago won a bunch of world championships. The only Super Bowl was 85.
I see.
Green Bay did, though. I think Green Bay was the first.
Yeah, Green Bay won the first couple, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Did you know at the time, like, hey, this dude is destined for superstardom at the beginning of the year? Like, I always wonder how that works out. I just coached my child's team. They're 6 and under boys, champions soccer. So technically I'm a champion as well, Jim, and we're on the same level now. But I had to buy myself my own trophy, but whatever. That's another story. But I didn't know this was a team of destiny, obviously, or these were God's children I was coaching. They were just a normal group of kids. When a season starts, in all sincerity, do you know, like, all right, shit, this is going to be a great team that could win a Super Bowl?
Well, I knew in 85 with the Bears for sure. You know, we had a chance to win in 84. We lost the NFC Championship game that year. And so we knew we were going to be good. You know, how the season unfolded, nobody probably could have predicted that. But, you know, yeah, we knew we were going to be good. We felt we should have won that Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. And the same thing was when I was in Green Bay. In 95, we lost the NFC Championship game. Coming to 96, I noticed that the Super Bowl was on the same day that we had played it 11 years prior to that. And I said, it's actually in New Orleans as well. I could have never predicted we're going to play the Patriots again. But I told Brett early on in the season, I said, hey, man, this is all, you know, unfolding exactly like it did in 85. I said, we've got a great defense. I said, just don't screw it up. And he didn't. I mean, we ended up 16-3, I believe, and winning it all. So it was a great way to end it. And it was a lot of fun hanging out with Brett.
Yeah, it's strange that you guys played together because your personalities seem to have meshed really, really well. Mm-hmm. And we're, to me, like when Dan and I talk on our sports show, you guys are in the same vein where you just, you know, young gunslingers taking hits. But it seemed like you guys were always having fun on the field. You don't see that too often out of quarterbacks today.
Yeah.
Pat Mahomes has kind of changed that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the rest of the league doesn't seem like they're having a lot of fun, nor does Tom Brady, especially last night. Mm, but it seems you two guys were always having fun. Why was it different for you two, you think?
I guess because we both loved to play. I mean, we just wanted to play. Winning was the most important thing to us. And just being out there on the field, actually being in the locker room with your buddies, that's even better. I mean, it's, you know, you make some great friendships there. And that's really what you miss, you know, once you're out of the game is just hanging out with your buddies and just, you know, doing the things you used to do.
Yeah, that's what it seems like. I wish more players played like they had fun again, where you don't typically see it anymore. Again,
and it's fun to watch people that play that way, regardless of their level of talent, really. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Just watching people.
All this social media now, they have to, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You got to play by the rules.
Social media and this and that.
Yeah.
Like it's not about, or it's about, you know, how many followers you got because you did something, you know. But that's, you know, games change quite a bit.
It has, yeah. I mean, like, I look at players like the confluence of a great player that clearly very much enjoys playing the game is not common, I don't think. You see guys like Deion Sanders is one of them.
Yeah.
He loved playing football. You know what I mean? That's why he's still involved in it now.
But when they pop up, like a Jim McMahon or a Deion and a Brett Favre, you remember them forever. And it feels like, you know, look, because I haven't seen you – since a documentary on SportsCenter, but my memories of you are still the guy that is having the most fun on the field and a complete blast and one of the best. But a lot of these guys, you know, they're more concerned about the branding and social media and everything like he was talking about, where they retire and you walk into them in a bar and you're like, oh yeah, you were that guy. Mm-hmm. But Jim McMahon lives forever. Like you're the dude forever.
Well, I appreciate that. I still, people still recognize me, so it's still a lot of fun. I just played in the Phoenix Coyotes alumni hockey golf tournament this past 3 days, so that it's cool to just be around other athletes and different sports, having a good time with them.
We got to get you to come out to our next golf thing. We do these events with the Special Operations Transition Fund, basically, is what it's called. And what they do is they take operators from Navy, Army, wherever, and help them transition into executive positions in corporate America. And we went to the event this year in Nashville. It was tons of veterans were there, but also people like Kid Rock, John Daly. So it's a fun time. A lot of celebrities show up and play. Give a lot of money to the charity and stuff like that. It's fun. That's the kind of stuff I like to do. I don't really care about golf that much, but I do like to drink and
I come down and support that. I do a lot of stuff with the troops, and I was told you earlier I just finished an event with some Navy SEALs down in San Diego and also back in Virginia. It's always a pleasure to be around you guys, and look forward to coming down to your event.
What else you got going on with veteran stuff?
I'm actually hosting a tournament here in Phoenix in May, and it's for the Veterans Lodge that they're building down outside of Destin, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a whole community of just veterans. It's going to be a world-class TBI center. There's going to be a school. There's housing for the families, and that's the first one that we're going to have throughout the country. We're going to try to do the next one on the West Coast somewhere, hopefully here in Phoenix, because I want to try to stay out of California as much as I can.
Yeah.
I can't figure why, though. So awesome there right now. What do you want to like see your family and shit?
Yeah, man.
I pay 60% in taxes.
Both of us lived in California for a stretch, and we're all done with California.
Jesus Christ, fuck that.
I grew up in San Jose, California. So it was a hell of a lot different back in the 60s and early 70s before I left. So it was a nice place to grow up, but I'm glad I'm out.
Yeah, same. We're amped to be out of there.
I mean, it was cool back in the day.
Yeah,
look, but now, come on, great. Man. Yeah, come
but
on,
13.5% state tax, who doesn't want to pay that? Who doesn't love homeless outside your door every day?
It's going up, boys. It's going up.
Yeah. It really is going up. I've got a wild one for you, and I want to ask you about your memories on the set of this film. One of my favorite movies of all time is Johnny B. Goode with Robert Downey Jr. and Anthony Michael Hall.
Wow, that's a crowd.
It's dude.
That was back when Robert Downey Jr. was Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, he was doing blow all the time, and it was great. Yeah, he was a blast. What was your memory of being on that film?
It was quite a long shoot. No, I owed Adidas a commercial, and so I think they were sponsoring that movie as well.
Oh, cool!
And so they decided to shoot the commercial during that movie. And so it just, I did my commercial part, and I just came off and hell, I can't remember what we talked about or said, but yeah, it was only a quick, 2 minute scene, but it was kind of fun.
Yeah. I remember it because again, it's one of my favorite movies of all time, but you give Johnny this jacket from this agent at USC, and you're like, hey man, you look like me. You should put this jacket on. And it was decked out head to toe in Adidas. And it was a big deal.
I still have it back too.
Do you really?
Yeah, I still have it. It's in the closet.
That's awesome. yeah, it's funny.
Wait, what was that last part?
It's a good looking jacket.
Yeah, that was a great jacket. I wear that every day.
I know. It's weird that Adidas, man, has not changed, and they've still held up over the years. Like, I still buy Adidas.
Yeah. I'm wearing Adidas right now, actually.
I got to go to Europe on Adidas, and got to see a lot of Europe, and saw where they made the shoes, and met the all the people involved, and had a great trip to Europe on them. So Adidas has always been a good company in my mind.
Yeah, but back to what Ross was saying a few minutes ago, you were kind of a trailblazer. I mean, frankly, it was kind of you, Namath, and OJ that became personalities while they were playing.
Yeah,
in
the
NFL, there's been a complaint for a long time, particularly through the late 90s and early 2000s. I guess with social media, it's changed a little bit now, but with players' ability to express themselves individually, because most of the time, and actually all the time when they're in action, you can't see their face, which seems like it's not that big a deal, but in branding it is, because you can see, if you show a picture of Michael Jordan's face just from a profile shot, every human being on earth knows who it is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
that's an important thing if you're trying to brand yourself and market yourself. You guys did it, though. You made a music video. Everybody in uniform with the helmets off. That was a big deal to do that. People thought it was kind of like, oh, they're just a bunch of knuckleheads doing whatever. But that was a big deal. I bet millions of dollars in contracts got signed because of that. Honestly, it seems crazy, but that's probably true. Just the way marketing works.
Yeah. What do you remember about the Super Bowl shuffle video?
The idea came to us. And this was the deal. They said, we're going to make a record. Okay. A record. They didn't say anything about a damn video. They said a record. And the proceeds were going to go to feed the homeless on, Thanksgiving and Christmas. And we're like, okay, cool. We'll do it. And I didn't I don't think anybody realized what the lyrics were at the time. But, once we read them, we're like, dude, it's halfway through the season and we're talking about winning the Super Bowl. I said, we better do it or, we're going to look like idiots.
But, yeah.
So we ended up, we did the record part. Everybody went to the studio and we did our voiceovers. And then a couple weeks later, it was Willie Galt's idea with a friend of his from LA, I guess. And they came to us a couple weeks later and they said, okay, now we have to do a video. And Walter Payton and I both said, no, that wasn't the deal. And they said, no, when you make a record now, that's what you do. I said, well, that wasn't the deal. We're not going. And they ended up filming this thing the day after that we lose to Miami on Monday night down in Miami. And so we got back from there about 3 or 4 in the morning. The guys had to be at the studio, I think, at 8 or 9 in the morning. They were there for, I don't know, 8 to 10 hours maybe. And they did their parts. And then Willie came to Walter and I didn't go. We told him we were not doing it. It wasn't part of the deal. And so we didn't show up. And then he came to us a couple days later and said, if we didn't do our parts, that they were going to sue us. And so what you see on that video is one pissed off white man had to do his part after practice one day in the racquetball court at Hallis Hall. That's where Walter and I filmed our segments. And it was after practice, and it was, I wasn't real happy about it. But people still talk about it. They still bring it up. And, I guess it's kind of funny now, because it ended up good, but it could have been ugly.
Yeah, it's funny, man, because, when you go back to the 80s, you remember Ghostbusters. They'll play Ghostbusters, the Super Bowl Shuffle, all that stuff. And it was, it was a huge moment in American culture at that point. And again, no other team had filmed a video or recorded a song about how great they were.
Wait, are you saying that you guys recorded that before you won?
Oh, yeah, we recorded. We were already, whatever we were after Miami, I think we were 12-0. So we had another 4 or 5 games left.
So you recorded the Super Bowl Shuffle before you won the Super Bowl.
There's no way a coach would allow that.
The kids these days call that big dick energy, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, we better not screw this up. We look like fools.
That's a lot of pressure. It's like all the Super Bowl championship t-shirts they print out for both teams. And then if you go to Eastern Africa right now, you'll see a bunch of teams that never actually won the Super Bowl. There's a lot of Rams Super Bowl 2019 jerseys and t-shirts floating around in poor countries around the world.
I'm sure all the children in Africa are wearing Atlanta Falcons Super Bowl champion shirts, especially after being up 28-3. Those were printed and done and out the door.
Could have been.
I know. By the way, I was at that game, and it was the worst day of my life. I'm a diehard Falcons fan. I'm from Atlanta. I was at that game. That was the worst experience of all time. Do you still watch the Super Bowl and follow the NFL closely at all?
No. I check in on some friends that are still in the league, that are coaching now. Andy Reid, a big one there. I've known Andy since 1977 or 78. He was at BYU with me. Ron Rivera is still coaching, check in on him. Leslie Frazier, I think, is still in Buffalo.
Yep.
Might be a couple other guys that are still coaching, but I just check scores and like everybody else. I don't watch the games for sure. Mm.
Yeah. That was
fun to play, not fun to watch it.
Yeah. The reason I ask is we've had a handful of NFL players who've been on the show where they said, hey, once I retired, I don't watch football anymore. And it's surprising to hear. Why is it for you?
I like to play it. I'd love the game, but just to, especially when I was injured, I hated being on the sidelines, being that close to it, not being able to get out there. Once I played 15 years, so I was, I'd had enough. I promised my daughter when she got to high school that I'd quit and would just stay in Chicago for the rest of the time so they could all graduate from one school. They had to travel everywhere I went for 8 years. They went as well for the first, from September to December, that's where they were. Then they'd go home to Chicago. But I retired at 37. I felt I could have played a couple more years, but I'd had enough. I got 2 rings and I said, you know what? Let's do something else.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you look back on it, can you pinpoint certain hits that think it caused the memory loss and things like that?
The biggest one was the Charlie Martin hit. He came from behind after the play was over and picked me up and dumped me on my head. And that the doc told me the only way that my C1 and 2 could get twisted that the way they are is if I get dumped on my head. And I said, well, I could show you the film. They still show it on ESPN every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that one. I remember the hit I took in New York when I was playing for the Vikings. My legs went numb. So I think that's the when I broke my neck, because I didn't realize I had a broken neck until probably about 10 years ago when I was going through workman's comp, and they did all the x-rays and they asked me, when did I break my neck? And I said, well, I got a pretty good idea, but nobody ever told me. And I played 3 more years after that. So I'm pretty lucky to be just be walking around.
Yeah, that hit by Charles Martin in 86 is probably the biggest piece of shit move an NFL guy has ever made.
Yeah, a lot of people say that's the dirtiest play in the history of the NFL. I think it is,
yeah. Particularly because...
yeah, being the top three, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe something Sue's done, stomping on people's heads and shit like that, but even that's not as bad as picking a dude up. Like, you were, what, 15, 20 yards away from any kind of action that was going on. You're in the backfield. Yeah, he's chasing you down.
I just kind of stepped up, and I threw the ball, and it was actually a shitty throw. I got picked. And the guy was touched right away. The play was over.
Right.
And I was just kind of let up, and I started walking off the field. And the next thing I know, I was laying on the ground. I'm like, what the hell was that?
Yeah. Yeah, that was a bad one.
Yeah, so after that is when I went, you know, at least they figured out my shoulder was really bad after that. Because I had some time off. I went out to see Frank Job in L.A. And within 5 minutes, he says, Your arm's coming out of the socket. I said, I know. I've been telling these guys that for 10 weeks, but they didn't believe it. So at least I figured out my shoulder was gone as well as my head at that point.
You're like a gingerbread man. I mean, they're really putting you back together here with icing at this point. It's it's crazy you didn't get any workman's comp or anything out of the
NFL. Not icing, though. It's what are you using for treatment? I know you use cannabis and shit like that, but are you using anything else? Because I've been part of a couple studies using for traumatic brain injury for things like psilocybin mushrooms, MDMA, ketamine, things like that. But have you experimented with any of that stuff, or is it just what do you got going on?
Well, I usually cannabis is my main form of controlling anything that's going on with me right now. I don't haven't taken a pain pill I think since 2000. I was still taking, you know, 30, 40 a month after I retired.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's just to get through the day. Mm-hmm. And then I moved here to Arizona 11 years ago and got my medical card. And, I've been strictly cannabis since then. You know, I do the gummies, the, you know, chocolates, the roll-ons. I mean, whatever product they have, I use them. Good. I mean, we have a system in our bodies for this plant. We're supposed to be using this plant.
Yeah, there's a lot of naturally occurring cannabinoids in your bloodstream, buddy.
Yeah, Dan uses it every day.
Yeah, I use it for a lot of reasons. Mostly boredom, to be honest. I'm not gonna lie. It's mostly boredom. Look, guys. But I have a lot of friends who have been on I have a lot of friends who have used opiates for long-term pain management, and a lot of them over the last year or two have been switched to ketamine actually instead. Because it's not chemically dependent.
Yeah. CBD, things like that. Yeah.
I mean, opiates are the devil, man. Honestly, that's the worst drug on earth, frankly.
Yeah. That and alcohol.
Oh.
Yeah. True. Do you drink it all?
I drink quite a bit. Usually when I'm playing golf is when I like
you just ask Jim McMahon if he drinks.
I know. I saw the Yeti you were pulling up there, and I was like, that a boy. He's having a couple.
Like I said, I just got done with 3 days with the hockey guys.
We got to get you on the golf course with
John Daly.
Yeah, with John Daly.
Oh, yeah, I played with John.
I stayed
at his house during his tournament. That was kind of quite fun.
With all those Arizona Razorbacks golf carts he has all over the fucking place. Did you see it? He posted one on social media the other day. It looks like a Cadillac.
Yeah.
Like it's, I'm like, dude, do you really buy 75 of these things? What'd you say?
He's got toys.
Oh, yeah. He's got plenty of toys.
Tons, man. Well, he also owns a golf course, so that's a write-off for him is those golf carts, which is amazing.
Yeah.
One thing that you and I have in common, Jim, besides being just, you know, hugely famous and powerful, probably two huge penises as well.
Yeah, big penises,
You were a punter at BYU for your freshman season. I was a punter in high school. I had to be the punter and the kicker for our teams. We didn't have one. How good were you at punting?
We didn't have to punt much, which was nice. But I wasn't that great a punter, but you know, I kicked good enough to make the varsity squad. That's all I wanted to do, was to make the team at the time. We had a senior quarterback who was an All-American. Mark Wilson was only going to be a sophomore at the time. And then myself, I was actually the third team quarterback. And then our starter got hurt in the fourth game of the year, I believe it was. And then I became the backup. But at BYU, even the backup doesn't get any reps. So I was still kicking. My sophomore year, I started out as the punter, but I ended up being the quarterback halfway through the season. And then they took the punting duties away once I became a starter. So it was fun to do, but like I said, we didn't have to kick it a hell of a lot.
What is it with quarterbacks at BYU? I've never been able to figure it out. Like, a guy like you who rages, right? I'm assuming you're not Mormon. Why did everybody go to BYU, and why was it a quarterback factory?
Well, the system, number one, you've got to play in a good system to have any kind of statistics at all. And that system is still the best one that I played for, even the seven NFL teams. They couldn't match the offense that we had.
Maybe not the offense, but the defense of that 85 Bears. Come on. You're never going to get that
grace of all time. Yeah.
I mean, they had I think they had 10 between the linebackers and edge rushers. They had 10 interceptions that year.
Yeah.
From the fucking seven guys in the box. Yeah, they had 10 interceptions. That's incredible.
Yeah, but it was, that's the reason they go, because of the system. Mm. I went because my dad wouldn't let me go to Vegas.
Really? Did you want to go to UNLV?
All I wanted to do was play baseball. That was my first love. I still love playing baseball. Mm. Haven't played in a hell of a long time. Haven't even done one of these fantasy camps lately. But that was the reason I was going to college. I got drafted out of high school to play baseball. But my dad said, you're going to college. So I said, all right, I want to play both sports. So all the schools that I went back to Nebraska, Oklahoma State, went to Boise State because I'd never been to Idaho. All the Utah schools, obviously. Because I transferred my junior year in high school to Utah. So I played my last 2 years of high school ball in Utah, which was quite a culture shock. But
from Southern California? Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, so the only two schools that said I could play both sports was Vegas and BYU. And I came, and Vegas was my last recruiting trip. And I said, Pops, I came home and said, Pops, I'm going to Vegas. I had a great time. He said, no, you're not. It's not a big enough school. And I think he was worried about me going on to the next level. And I said, hey, I'm not worried about that. I said, I'm worried about having some fun in college and making some money. I said, they just offered me a house, car, money, easy job at the casino. I mean, hell, I could have been, I would have been probably a millionaire before I left school. But Pop said no. And that's how I ended up at BYU. So I did get to play baseball my freshman year. I played about 10 games. But I couldn't get out of spring football practice. Mm-hmm. So I play a game of a doubleheader. And I was playing in the outfield and throwing the ball from the outfield and throwing the ball from the pocket. So a hell of a lot different. So I was starting to have arm problems then. So I had to make a decision. And since football was my scholarship, I played my last baseball game then. So that's how I ended up there.
That's crazy, man. Looking back at it, who do you think the best BYU quarterback was of all time? I mean, obviously Steve Young went there. Yourself, and multiple Heisman winners there.
Ty Detmer played, I think, four years there. So he's got some unbelievable statistics. Mm. But like I said, it's all about, the system and the team around you. And, I was lucky enough to be the first QB to win a bowl game for him. We won two bowl games when I was there. So it was nice to be able to do that. But yeah, we all had our moments. So
yeah,
I'm not going to say I was the best, even though in my opinion, and if you talk to my dad, yeah, for sure. But
you probably made the best music video of anybody that's ever attended BYU.
Yeah. So at least you have that.
They're not really known for music.
No.
I don't think it's allowed there, actually, is it?
Tabernacle Choir, Donnie and Marie. They got a lot of music.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Who doesn't love Donnie and Marie? They're still in Vegas pretending to be brother and sister and not lovers.
Yeah, well, Donnie and Marie love Donnie and Marie, that's for sure.
Yeah. Every time I drive by them, that billboard in Vegas, because like, we go to, Dan and I go to Vegas a lot.
It's like, come on, man.
Yeah, it's like, dude, you guys have been fucking for how many years at this point? Like, I don't care, but just tell people, like, hey, we're Donnie and Marie. We're like, brother and sister.
It's like somebody with a bad spray tan. Like, you're not fooling anybody.
Yeah.
We all know what's going on here. Come on.
Do you know them?
Yeah, actually, Donnie's brother Jay came out for spring football practice one year.
Oh, no kidding.
And did Jay tell you anything?
I think Jay actually played some junior varsity football for us for a couple games, if my memory's correct. But I remember they came out, and I think Donnie was wearing purple socks, and our defense couldn't wait to hit him. Yeah, I think they enjoyed the day. They started the Children's Miracle Network telethon way back in the day. Mm-hmm. And actually I did their telethon for them one year, and one of their board members was actually a member at Augusta National, and so I got to play that because I did that telethon. So I've been to Augusta three times now because of that. So it was a good time.
Yeah, and I think Donnie and Marie are still having a good time. You didn't answer the question. Did Jay tell you afterwards of like, hey, no, man.
I know no family secrets here. I don't know what's going on.
Because you realize, like, if you knew that secret and that drop today, like, that would be the greatest thing of all time. Of like, hey, not only was he on the best Super Bowl team ever, but he also let it be known that Donnie and Marie were definitely fucking.
I want to make that clear. I did not let that be known. That was not my idea. I did not confirm.
It has always been my suspicion whenever I go to Vegas. I always laugh as I pass that sign. And whoever's with me, no matter, even my parents, I think I told my parents one time we were in a cab, and I just go, they were looking at me. My dad was like, ah, Jesus, Donnie Marie are still playing? I was like, well, they're still fucking. So yeah, they're going to make some money. But
I don't think they're hurting for money.
You wonder, you know, when you see them for like what, 30 years in Vegas, you're like, dude, how long can you
do that?
That's
the only life they know. What else would they do? Like, they've got to be worth a couple, like at least 15, 20 million each, you would think, right?
I don't know. Walk away, spend more time with their real families. Like, who knows, you know? Like,
well, they're Mormons, so they have big families. So exactly. Maybe that's why they're still working, because they have 75 grandchildren.
Who knows? Who knows? It's just hard to picture Jim McMahon hanging out like at BYU with all the Mormons, like, you know.
Well,
that there's anything wrong with being a Mormon.
No,
but
it's just a different crowd.
Yeah,
30 years to graduate. So I don't tell how much class I went to.
Well, they did.
I enjoyed during the week. I enjoyed practice. I enjoyed playing on Friday night or Saturday whenever I got to play. But other than that, it was not what most people's college life was like.
Right. Well, Park City's not too far away.
I think, yeah. Well, Park City. I mean, Roy, where I played my last 2 years of high school ball, was only an hour and a half away. So that's where I spent most of my time. My older brother and a good friend of mine, who's still a good friend of mine, went to Weber State right there in Ogden. So that's where I spent my weekends anyway. After the game, my car back.
Yeah, it's a good place to shoot guns.
Yeah, well, how was your relationship with Mike Ditka, by the way? We got a picture, autographed picture of him on our set, flipping off a photographer, which was nice of him to sign for us.
He was flipping me off in that picture, I think.
That's probably true.
Are you guys, were you guys close? Do you still chat?
Yeah, I see him every once in a while. Different functions. If I'm in Chicago, I usually would eat at his restaurant, but that unfortunately closed this year due to all this crazy. I think we had a interesting relationship, to say the least. I thought he did a great job when he first became head coach. He got rid of guys that were just kind of hanging around collecting checks. He got guys in there who wanted to work, and we definitely worked. I mean, we worked our ass off. We didn't have any, buddy-buddy sessions, you know, whether it was offensive period or defensive period, everything was live. And, he said, this is the only way to learn how to play is by hitting people, getting hit. And so we did that to each other for the 7 years I was there. And I think it just wore us down. I think that was a big reason why we lost in the playoffs a lot, because we were tired. Not only of beating the hell out of each other every day for 3 days, and then you play a game on Sunday, but, you know, after practice, he's running us to death. I mean, it was just crazy. But I always told him, I tell him to this day, I would love to play with the guy. He was a great football player, hell of a tight end. And I think if he'd ever been in my huddle, he would have had a different view of me, because he had understood that I actually knew what the hell I was doing. He thought a lot of times I did things just to piss him off. And I said, Mike, you know, I'm trying to win games here. And some of the stuff you send in ain't going to work or ain't going to get it done. And sometimes it would work. Sometimes it wouldn't. But I would, you know, if I changed the play and it didn't work, I'd say, look, I screwed up, you know. But I thought I could make a play, and that's how I was taught in college. If you can exploit something on the defense, to do it. And so that's how I always played.
Man, that's cool. Yeah, because I always wondered, you know, if you guys hung out in real life off the field again, it's the greatest team of all time. So you would expect, you guys are always lumped in together. You know, Refrigerator Perry, obviously Walter Payton and those guys. And you wonder if you're friends in real life. Because, you know, like in Hollywood, for example, like there's movies that I've done. I just didn't get along with the people off screen, and everybody was so shocked. They're like, I don't understand. You didn't like hanging out? And I was like, no, I hated them.
there's a lot of people. I mean, not a lot of people, but, you know, most of the guys that you play with, I think you get along with. I know I did. Like I said, I played for 7 different teams, and I don't remember having problems with maybe 2 guys out of those 7 teams. And I didn't have a problem. They might have had a problem with me, but you know, you're there to do a job, and your job is to win ball games. That's all I cared about. I didn't care about what the media thought. I didn't care what sometimes the coaches thought. And that's why, I think a lot of my offensive linemen, when I got in the huddle, they listened to what I said, not what the guys were saying as they were coming into the huddle with a play or anything like that. I said, this is what we're running. And they all understood that I knew what I was doing. And so they always had my back. So it was great doing that.
Yeah. By the way, that statement you just made is the same one that Donny Osmond says to the crew before he goes on stage in Vegas with Marie. So, you know, we're going to play hard tonight. We're going to keep it fresh and keep it together when we go out there on stage and try to figure it out.
You know, Utah's going to be pissed at me now.
He's going to get a call from Donny Osmond.
He's going to get a call from Donny Osmond. I can't wait. Tell him we can play in the charity golf game together.
Yeah.
And figure some things out. He can help me with my short game. Let me ask you, do you watch a guy like Joe Burrow, like the new kids that are coming into the game? Joe Burrow was obviously an electric talent this year for the NFL. Do you watch him get buried by a shitty offensive line? And do you say, man, demand a trade and go to a different team like an Eli Manning or something like that?
Well, that's the problem with being a number one pick. You're going to go somewhere where they're probably not very good.
Right.
And doesn't matter who you are as a quarterback. If you don't got 5 guys up front, I never cared who my receivers, running backs, I wanted 5 guys I could trust up front. And when you got that, I mean, you can do pretty much whatever you want. Because, you know, there's very little difference between talent-wise between receivers, running backs, tight ends in this league. But it's the QB's got to get it done, but they can't get it done with 5 guys.
Well, particularly running back. How many times has a running back got a big contract and that's worked out?
None.
I mean, think it's ever worked.
Look, he had the advantage of playing with Walter Payton, and that's a different story. I mean, it was the best of all time. But in today's game, like, yeah, you're right. The running backs are kind of the same. You can draft those later on.
Yeah, but even if you do have a guy that's 24 or 25 and you think this person is a truly generational talent, even when they pay them, it still doesn't work out most of the time. Like, people thought that about Zeke.
Yeah.
He was the best running back in the league, maybe other than Christian McCaffrey, and he's not.
No. And look, you know,
like the difference between the best and the second best, or the middle of the pack, isn't, like, I think that's what you're saying. The difference between the absolute best running back, unless it's somebody like Barry or Walter Payton, somebody, Emmitt Smith, one of these guys, the difference between great and pretty good isn't big enough to spend $15, $20 million a year on this guy. It's just not.
Yeah, I agree.
Changed. All the systems now, everything, they're throwing the ball all over the field.
Yeah.
So the running back, it's not a big priority anymore, but it should be, because if you can't run the ball when you need to, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, and I agree. But, you know, when you see a draft like the one that's coming up in 2021, it appears as if three out of the first 10 picks will probably be quarterbacks. Number one is obviously going to be the Jets and Trevor Lawrence. Would you tell Trevor with a year left, like, hey, man, just stay in college because you don't get your leg broken half because you have no offensive line for the New York Jets?
Well, he does have another year of eligibility. I didn't know that.
He does, yeah.
Yeah, he's a junior.
Yeah, he's from the little bit that I've seen of him, he looks pretty damn good. Mm. So he might come out and take the money, but again, it's going to depend on where you go.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tell him wait till after the draft to clear himself, see who's going to get the first pick.
Yeah.
Can you do that? Yeah. That was a question actually by one of our listeners.
Declare right before, but by then he'd know who the first pick is.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. You'll definitely be able to
decide not to.
But I mean, it's going to be the Jets.
Right? Yeah, it's going to be the Jets. Yeah, they're going to go defeated this year.
They are intentionally losing games now, it seems. So,
yeah, 0-16.
Yeah, I feel like if I'm Lawrence, particularly after, because we at the when Joe Burrow got drafted last year
on this show, we said he's going to get murdered. Dan actually said week six.
I thought it was going to be by week six, to be honest. But he lasted a little bit longer than that, thankfully. Yeah, but he did get knocked out eventually. It's a David Carr situation. Mm-hmm. From back in the day with the Texans. I mean, you put a guy like that wants to stay in the pocket and throw the ball with shitty offensive linemen, and
you're going
to
get crushed.
And if you're Trevor Lawrence, you feel like if I'm him, I feel like I'm probably a generational talent. He's got the body for it and the brain for it. He can read defenses. He's very athletic, very smart guy, a lot of good pedigree. And as a player, you want to win games for sure, but you also have to maximize your time on the field.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you know, if you want to make money doing this stuff, you got to do that. I just don't see how you do it with the Jets. Either way, like the Jets are going to.
If you're the first pick in the draft, your signing bonus should set you up for life the way that it's going now. But
yeah, maybe.
I agree with you. It's going to be tough wherever those first rounders go.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be really difficult because, geez, Trevor Lawrence is going to get killed. And, you know, they need everything on that team because I believe you played with Frank Gore, right? And he's still playing.
Probably.
Was Frank Gore still in the league when you were playing the running back? I'm kidding. That guy's like 84 years old.
Well, my last year was 96, so I don't know when he started.
No, not that long ago. Sure. He hasn't been in the league for 24 years.
He's been in for what? He's 37 years old.
He's 37, yeah. He's been in the league since 2005.
Yeah, they're the Jets' starting running back is 37 years old, which for a running back is an eternity at that point.
That's a testament to that guy and his work ethic.
Yeah, he's a stud. Adrian Peterson's the same.
Taking a lot of hits being a running back. That's a tough position.
Yeah.
Do you remember Emmitt Smith? In I think it was the 93 Super Bowl, his shoulder was dislocated,
mm-hmm.
and he still ran the ball.
Yeah.
And that was interesting to me.
Look, you don't stop, dude. If you're going to win a Super Bowl, you're going all out, right?
He's a tough dude.
It's amazing what that xylocaine and all that other stuff they shoot.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's incredible. Bang, I mean,
pain goes away for an hour or two. So you can get the game.
So that was real, right? They were just shooting you guys up in the locker room and saying, hey, let's get back at it. Like, we can win this.
I had a broken throwing hand in 84 before I tore my kidney up. And so they shot my hand for six games in a row.
Oof.
My throwing hand. So, and then people kept asking, why can't you throw a spiral? I go, shit, I can't feel the ball.
Wow.
I mean, they'd hit a nerve. I'd usually be numb to my elbow. So the ball was kind of. It still get there. It was just ugly.
How many picks you throw in that span?
I don't know how many, but that's no fun. I got shot in my shoulder because they kept telling me there was nothing wrong with my shoulder, and I had no labrum. I mean, it was just popping in and out all the time. I was shot with all kinds of stuff, and I was eating so many painkillers and muscle relaxers just to play. I don't remember a hell of a lot of my career.
Man. It sounds like Dan on this podcast.
Yeah, it's my day-to-day life.
Yeah, Dan doesn't remember. I mean, we've done almost 800, 900 shows on this one. Dan probably remembers about 20 or 30.
The problem with me is that it's not just physical pain.
Yeah, it's the mental. It's the memories you can't forget.
Yeah.
And that's the problem with Donnie and Marie Osmond, too. It's what you can't tell you. You knew I had to bring it back. I had to circle back on that. Jim, now's the point in the show where we get to the drinking bro of the week, which is someone who has inspired you or helped you become the man you are today. Who would you like to give the drinking bro of the week to?
Oh, boy.
Anybody in Vegas?
My dad. Yeah, my dad was my coach. My dad taught me taught me all the fundamentals of the sports and said, if you're fundamentally sound, you can play anything. Mm. But if you're fundamentally sound and you've got talent, you can go a long way. So I always remember that, and he's still my biggest fan. So he's the one who's directed me to where I am.
That's awesome.
But I'll have a drink for him because he doesn't drink much.
Well,
yeah. Well,
I'll have a couple for him too.
Yeah, we'll have about 8 to 9 today for him as well, obviously, on Drinking Bros. For your dad, obviously. And then I'll save a couple aside for Donnie Marie. But, that's how I'm going to get down today in your honor. Because to me, we don't do this often, but, you're going to be my drinking bro of the week today. Because again, as a child, like there's very few athletes that have a lasting memory of who you were and what you aspired to be. And like, dude, I wanted to be the coolest guy on the field, like Jim McMahon. Like, dude, I still wear headbands to this day because of Jim McMahon. So therefore you're my drinking bro of the week. You were the one that changed the game for me. Like I've always, Dan will attest to this. I always liked the biggest personalities on the field. So baseball was Ricky Henderson, Jim McMahon for football, Deion Sanders after you. I like big personalities who were also great and could back it up on the field because I enjoy watching the game and I enjoy watching people who are passionate about the game. And you, my man, were the very first for me as a child. So thank you.
Hey, I appreciate that, bud. Never wanted to be anybody else but me. So.
Yeah.
That's the greatest line of all time. That's what I say to myself every day, you know? Never wanted to be anybody else but Ross Patterson today, you know? So did Donnie and Marie, by the way. But to get out of here, where can everybody find you? Do you do social media? Do you do charities?
Tickets for the show or what?
We're gonna have you come down to the golf tournament. We're gonna hire a Donnie Marie impersonator just to follow you around the whole time and sing songs. Anytime anybody tries to talk to you or interview you, they're just gonna show up out of nowhere and start singing a song like a mariachi band at a fucking Mexican restaurant. Can you imagine that shit?
As soon as this is over, we're taking you to Vegas. Like as soon as the COVID bullshit's over, we're taking you to Vegas. Yeah. It's going to be the four of us in the front row after just a day full of like day drinking.
Yeah, get wrecked.
Hard day drinking, the old school pills that you used to take in the late 90s.
Black Beauties.
Yes.
Freebird, man.
Start screaming out Freebird to Donnie and Marie. Oh, boy. What I wouldn't give for just one night of Donnie and Marie, the three of us, and then just to go back to their hotel room and see if they go into different rooms. You know what I'm saying? You're welcome for this, Jim. You're welcome for every second of it today. And thank you for being on the show. Seriously, this is a huge joy for us.
Hey, I appreciate you being on this segment with Donnie and Marie.
For Jim McMahon, Anthony Holloway, I'm Ross Patterson. This is the Drinking Bros. Good night, everyone.